legend to press freedom. Chelsea Manning's torture, being put back into solitary confinement, is trying to squeeze her to say things that aren't true to let them prosecute WikiLeaks. And all of the journalists who have spent 3 years claiming to be so worried about the threats to press freedom are utterly silent about what the Trump administration's real threat to press freedom is, which is this attempt to prosecute WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, abusing Chelsea Manning to do it in order to criminalize journalism, which is the publication of top secret documents that journalists do every day. And I hope that gets way more attention.
We're going to have to leave it there. I thank you both so much. Pulitzer Prize winning journalists Glenn Greenwald and David K. Johnston. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Community Forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion on Tuesday, March 26th at 7 p.m. at City Hall in Portland. The Community Forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion will address the realities of climate breakdown and the expansion of fossil fuels infrastructure. The event will pose questions about oil train traffic along the Columbia River, impacts on First Nations, and more. Again, that's the Community Forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion on Tuesday, March 26th at 7 p.m. at City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland, the time is 5:01 and 47 seconds. It's time for your evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, electric scooters are coming back to Portland.
Avocados are being recalled in 6 states, but not in Oregon.
And in international news, Israel attacks Gaza while Netanyahu is visiting Trump.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 25th, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Ray Bodwell. The Portland Bureau of Transportation announced this morning that e-scooters will be returning to the city in April. The Bureau said that they would begin taking applications from scooter companies today, and that scooters could be back on the street as early as April 26th. The program is scheduled to run for 1 year. The initial plan calls for 2,500 scooters to operate, but has allowances for an increase to as many as 15,000. To reach that number, scooter companies must, quote, qualify for incentives, end quote, by demonstrating that they have addressed citizen complaints that resulted during the 5-month trial period in 2018. Incentives include eliminating improper parking, sidewalk riding, boosting ridership in East Portland, and making available scooters with seats for disabled riders. Over 700,000 scooter trips were taken during last summer's trial period, and disability rights advocates complained that the city and the companies did not do enough to penalize users who rode on the sidewalks. But the new rules will put pressure on the companies to penalize scooter riders who illegally ride on sidewalks by warning them through their smartphone apps, issuing fines, or banning their use entirely. The city has also said that companies that also provide seated access scooters and the ability to lock scooters to bike racks will have an advantage when making their application.
Stormy Daniels' attorney, Michael Avenatti, allegedly tried to extort the Nike Corporation into giving him more than $20 million to hush up a pay-to-play amateur basketball fraud that Avenatti said was linked to the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NCAA. That's according to federal prosecutors who filed charges against the infamous attorney today. The feds say Avenatti threatened Nike officials with a public scandal timed to blow up right before the company's quarterly earnings report and just before the start of March Madness. College sports has been rocked over the past 2 years as federal prosecutors from New York uncovered a network of corruption in college sports. The investigation found that Adidas employees sent money to top college athletes who signed on to play with Adidas-linked colleges, but Nike had not been linked to the scandals by prosecutors.
As many as 2,000 protesters rallied Saturday at the Capitol in Salem in support of gun rights. The rally, called Defend the Second, opposed current legislation impacting unrestricted gun ownership. The Associated Press reports that the rally was organized by Oregon-based gun manufacturers Radian Weapons and Noveski Rifle Works. Current legislative policies on the table in the state legislature include mandatory gun locks, defining assault rifles, limiting ammunition purchases, limiting the size of magazines, and how many rounds of ammunition consumers can purchase.
The Oregon Department of Wildlife said last week they found a new group of wolves in the southern Oregon Cascade Mountains. Wolf activity has been reported in Douglas and Lane counties for several years, but in late 2018, biologists found wolf tracks. In February, cameras captured images of three wolves in the Umpqua National Forest. The species has been making a comeback after being wiped out 70 years ago by a bounty hunting program. Wolves lost endangered status under Oregon law in 2015 when the state's population hit 81 wolves and are no longer federally protected in the eastern third of the state. As of early 2018, there were at least 124 wolves in Oregon.
The media watchdog website Muckrock last week issued a report finding Oregon is the worst state in America for getting timely public records by invoking the Freedom of Information Act. The Freedom of Information Act is a federal law designed to provide public access to government documents. The idea is that transparency is good for democracy. States that landed at the top of the list are Vermont, Idaho, and Rhode Island, all of which answer FOIA requests within 2 weeks. In Oregon, the Muckrock report showed that the average document request takes 148 days. Oregon law gives a 15-day time limit for FOIA responses, but many government agencies take advantage of a loophole in the law that allows many grounds to delay compliance.
The Oregonian's reporting this afternoon that for the third time in a year, the state's employee email systems have been shut down by hackers. Last week, Oregon Chief Information Officer Terrence Woods issued a memo saying one employee's email was hacked, allowing hackers to use that account for an email spam campaign. In response, Outlook, MSN, and Hotmail have all blacklisted emails with the extensions at oregon.gov and at state.or.us. The same thing happened last month, officials say. Last June, at oregon.gov was blacklisted because a state employee clicked on a phishing email, giving hackers the opportunity to send more than 8 million spam emails from the account. Bureaus affected by the hackers include the Department of State Lands and the Department of Energy. The Oregonian reports that there is no simple, instant fix. Rather, each time the state email system has been compromised, the government must work to rebuild the reputation of its email accounts with providers so they will once again accept state emails.
A big protest is scheduled for tomorrow night at Portland City Hall against the Zenith Energy tar sands oil terminal expansion. Despite a policy passed by city officials to limit petrochemical production in the city, activists say that expansion of Zenith Oil's terminal will bring more oil trains through Portland. Located in Portland's City Hall atrium, the event opens with tabling at 6:30 and speakers starting at 7 p.m. tomorrow night. One of the speakers is Patricia Kohlberg, a KBOO volunteer and a medical professional who will speak about the health impacts of fracked oil chemicals in the air. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Patricia today about the dangers of expanding the oil terminal.
The main problem comes with the risk of fire, explosion, and toxic spills. This, they call it, it's a bitumen oil. It's a crude oil that then is cut to make it, it's cut with a whole bunch of compounds in order to make it thin enough so that they can run it through the pipes and put it into the oil train. So they add a whole bunch of toxics to it. And let me just mention a few of those. One is benzene, which is a known carcinogen. And another one is hydrogen sulfide, which is a really, really toxic chemical that if it gets into the air or into the water, if you become exposed to it at low levels, there's just maybe some eye irritation or irritation of the nose and the airway, but at higher levels, it can actually cause fluid buildup in the lungs. It can cause loss of consciousness, and it can, at very high levels, can cause very rapid death. This is an extremely toxic chemical that could be released into our environment in any kind of toxic smoke plume or if the oil is spilled. This represents a real risk to the people who live near those railways. The operations themselves are problematic, and I'll mention just one thing, and that's the diesel particulate matter. This is only going to add to that by pumping more diesel particulate matter into the air. And diesel particulate matter has a whole host of bad toxic effects, including lung disease, heart disease, developmental disorders. It's harmful to a developing fetus. We just don't need more of that stuff in our air. And that's a problem even if the oil train never spills, never explodes, never catches on fire.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth report on an upcoming workshop on restorative justice by Resolutions Northwest. At 6, the Troublemakers School is back. Labor Radio discusses the troublemakers wing of the labor movement. At 6:30 on Prison Pipeline, Adam Carpinelli interviews Roshani Takor with the Columbia River Correctional Institution Comedy School. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, rain, high near 55, southeast wind around 9 miles per hour. Tomorrow, patchy fog becoming sunny in the afternoon with a high near 61. Today in history, in 1931, 50 people were killed in riots that broke out in India. Mahatma Gandhi was one of the many people assaulted. And in 1954, RCA manufactured its first color TV set and began mass production. The joke of the day is from Seth Meyers, who says 55% of Americans are in favor of abolishing the Electoral College, but unfortunately, because of the Electoral College, 55% is less than half.
Coalition of Community Health Clinics puts on regular forum events to talk about trending issues and how our healthcare industries work, and sometimes how they don't work. But this week, the group is taking on a slightly different issue, jobs in healthcare. This Wednesday's healthcare forum topic is how to create a health safety net workforce. Live in the studio with us tonight is Coalition of Community Health Clinics Executive Director Sam Chase. Sam, thank you so much for taking time to come in and talk to us tonight.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Let's start off and talk a little bit about your organization. For our listeners who really aren't familiar with it, what does the Coalition of Community Healthcare Clinics do?
Well, the Coalition of Community Health Clinics is a coalition of 16 clinics that are in our Portland area. They are clinics that range from somewhat small, like some may have heard of North by Northeast or Children's Community Clinic, to much larger ones like Old Town, Central City Concerns Old Town Clinic, or NARA, or even OHSU's Family Medicine at Richmond, and a number of other clinics. They together serve 80,000 people annually. By far and away, the majority of those folks are Oregon Health Plan members or uninsured.
Wow. So what are some of the issues you see out there facing health clinics in Oregon right now?
Well, of course, we're seeing the disparity between rich and poor grow, and we're seeing a continued level of patients coming into the clinics and growing. So we are seeing that folks are coming in. They're coming in often in traumatic life situations. They have mental health needs. They have a tremendous amount of housing needs and other supports that include a lot of upstream kind of care that they're not getting.
You mentioned you're taking care of 80,000 patients, which, you know, my math skills aren't what they once were, but that's still over 10% of the population here in Portland. So I'd like to take a few minutes to dig into the issue of workforce development. That's got to be critical for you, and how it impacts the clinics. What is at the heart of your health forum on Wednesday morning?
Well, it really starts with the patients and what the patients need. And one of the things that I learned more recently is that access to healthcare doesn't mean, oh, I've got a healthcare plan and, you know, I even have a clinic nearby. That doesn't create access for many, many people in our community, for people who look different, you know, or than maybe the folks in that clinic, maybe people who have, I guess it's folks being able to feel like they're going into a clinic where they see people that they can identify with. And so that may be folks who share their life experiences, share their color of their skin, can identify with who they love. And that is often not the case when folks go into a clinic. You might even have a scenario where one of the things that we've heard from patients a number of times is, you know, I go into this clinic, I don't see anybody I identify with. I get a survey, and it asks me how many times do I have to answer this survey that asks me how often I use drugs and alcohol?
Right.
And it becomes a situation where they don't trust the institution that they're going to. And so how can we, you know, help provide a workforce that can be much more culturally responsive and help them with culturally specific issues?
A workforce that can be empathetic and can understand the background and make a connection on a one-on-one basis, as opposed to the kind of sterile, for lack of a better word, workforce that you might get in a more traditional environment.
Absolutely.
Am I hearing that right?
Yes.
Great. And so what does it mean when you say a safety net workforce?
Well, we are, you know, often the place that folks have as their option to go to for getting their health needs met, and may not have a lot of other options. And so a safety net is really sort of the metaphor of the place that folks have as their last opportunity to get their health care needs met. And so we are the doorway for a lot of the folks who are out in our community really struggling with trauma, that are struggling with mental health issues, that are living in homelessness or on the verge of homelessness, that are facing challenges on a day-to-day level that many of us don't have to experience. And so those clinics are the community clinics that are around our region that are largely nonprofit organizations that are providing this service. And it's to a very large percentage of our lowest income populations.
Yeah. So what are the issues that make it hard for you to get and retain health workers?
Well, there are a whole range of things. But, you know, what we're really doing at our forum on Wednesday is to hear from the folks who are working industry and who are also patients. And so it's a community forum where folks from, you know, broad range of lived experiences, a broad range of organizations are coming together to really share, you know, what are the things that they can help us identify and help us address. We know that there are some programs and strategies out there that are moving in the right direction. One of them is around immigrant credentialing,
right,
which is very interesting. Many of us have had a cab ride or other experiences with a doctor or a nurse or a medical assistant, and they're driving because they aren't credentialed in the United States. They may have received a professional degree in another country, but it's very difficult to engage and get credentialed in the United States. So one of the things we're very interested in helping folks move forward are programs and strategies to get those folks in our workforce. What a great opportunity to tap into folks who are already skilled up here, working, ready to go, that want to participate in our healthcare system.
Yeah, I find that particularly ironic, since more and more Americans seem to be going offshore for procedures. Obviously, that would imply that the quality of medical care in much of the world is as good or better than here. Yet it seems a shame to put up these barriers to prevent, you know, skilled and trained healthcare workers from getting proper accreditation here. What, you know, specifically can be done?
Well, there are some folks who, one of the things that needs to happen is that the healthcare providers need to be really engaged in hosting and creating a relationship with those folks and helping them through the process of getting integrated into how we operate our systems here within our country, and really just shepherding folks through that process. That's a part of it that's, I think, really important. We also see a tremendous advantage in the clinics, even during that phase, which is that you have somebody who can really support some of the patients in a way that nobody else in the clinic can. One of the things that we see also is that there's a tremendous need not just to get folks in at the entry level into the workforce, you know, into the healthcare workforce, but at all levels.
Right.
And so we need folks, not just medical assistants, not just folks who you see when you walk into the clinic, but those folks who are, you know, the nurses, the doctors, the psychologists, all of those positions that really interact with the patients are very important places for us to have more diversity.
Yeah, and you mentioned nurses just now, and I know that in past years we've had problems training and accrediting nurses in Oregon. What are all the jobs we're talking about right now? It's not just nurses. You're looking for help in all areas, and we're looking for healthcare professionals at all levels, correct?
Medical assistants, nurses, healthcare workers, doctors, psychologists, really in all of those areas we need to, you know, we have a program that we run independently, which is serving folks in permanent supportive housing and in housing that are you know, some of our most challenged residents in terms of getting services and needs met. We had staff spend a significant amount of time yesterday looking for somebody who could serve this patient. This patient really wanted to see an African-American doctor. Our staff spent a number of hours searching, and we're not able to find a place for this person to go.
And so the comfort level is there, and there's always the concern that because that's lacking, they're not even going to come in for the care that they need in many cases, just because of that disconnection.
And there's a trust that hasn't been established there,
right,
that needs to, you know, take hold.
So what are some of the aspects of community health clinics that members of the public and our listeners may not be aware of? You know, what have you learned in your job that you think would surprise the public if they knew it?
Well, for me, it was one is the tremendous number of folks that are being served by our community health clinics. The health clinics are not the well-financed, you know, hospital and health systems. They are really investing everything that comes in back into the services that they provide. So the volume of that our community clinics do is, you know, pretty incredible. Our members, not only do they serve 80,000 people annually, they do that in about 350,000 visits a year. So people do come, you know, when they have multiples. A relationship, that's people are coming back into the clinic. That's, I think, one very important. The other is, I spent much of my, you know, really life and career focused on affordable housing and advancing affordable housing strategies. And I really want to focus on healthcare, because people can't get ahead if they don't have, you know, if they're not healthy. Mm-hmm. And getting into the healthcare community, I realized now, again, how important the affordable housing component is. And over again, I hear from the medical community how critical it is that folks have that stable housing to be able to get all of these other services to happen and to really be able to help people establish their own road forward to succeed in life.
It's hard to be healthy if you don't have a roof over your head, isn't it?
That's right.
It's pretty simple when you think about it, and it's a shame. Who is speaking at the forum, and what knowledge are they bringing to the table? What are they sharing with the attendees?
So we have some great speakers, and it's designed for the speakers to share a little bit, and then really for some interactive small group discussions, because it's the folks that are attending that are really the rich source of information to kind of help move some of these strategies forward. But we have Stacy Triplett, who is from Work Systems, Inc. She's their community programs manager. And Work Systems really focuses on workforce strategies, and they have some specific healthcare strategies that they're working on. We have Alana Silverman, who is with Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare, and she's the human resources director and has really moved forward some pretty innovative strategies to get people not just, you know, to recruit folks into the workforce, but to get folks to, you know, to help folks advance and want to stay in that clinic and to retain their workforce. And then we have Anthony De Los Reyes, who is someone who is a career coach working on the professional immigrant credentialing program that I was talking about. You know, one point I would really make is that part of the work that we need to do is not just to, you know, try to get healthcare workers, a diversity of healthcare workers from Seattle to here, and Seattle trying to get there. This is an opportunity where our economy is strong, the healthcare industry is strong, and now is the time where we need to make sure we're giving everybody the opportunity to succeed in that workforce and provide apprenticeships, trainings, and other kinds of strategies that help bring people into the industry.
And that really leads me to this important question. Who should come to your forum, and how can KBOO listeners help you support your forum?
Well, I would go to www.coalitionclinics.org, and that's a place where you can really sign up for our forum. And we would love to have, we want everybody that is interested in this topic to come to this forum. I think, you know, many of us are just folks who've been in the healthcare system and had experiences with it. Right. Others have worked in it. There are a wide range of experiences we want to capture and get folks input on.
Okay. Well, Sam, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share this with our listeners. This is important, and I want to summarize. Listeners can attend the free Coalition of Community Clinics Healthcare Forum this Wednesday morning from 8 to 9:30 at the State of Oregon Office Building. And they are asking that you please sign up in advance at the website, and I'm going to repeat that website again. It is Coalition Clinics, and that's one word, Coalition Clinics, plural, .org. Sam, once again, thank you so much.
And we'll have some coffee and a few light snacks for folks for breakfast beforehand.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
And now it's time for Current Cast, a daily podcast highlighting issues affecting water.
Not to let it go on this Current Cast. Red-eared sliders are popular pet turtles, but according to Sarah Stallman of Pennsylvania Sea Grant,
people don't often realize that these turtles can grow to be up to 12 inches, and they can actually live longer than 30 years. So most pet owners just aren't prepared for that long-term commitment. And so what they do is what they feel is best for the turtle, and that's to release them into the wild.
But that can harm local ecosystems.
They're very aggressive, and they can outcompete our native turtles for food and nesting sites.
So she recommends people do their homework before buying a turtle and return or rehome unwanted pets instead of releasing them. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
One California avocado grower has issued a recall due to the discovery of listeria, a bacteria that can cause serious illness. The recall is effective in California, Arizona, Florida, New Hampshire, North Carolina, and Wisconsin, but not in Oregon. The avocados in question are grown organically by Henry Avocado in Escondido, California. Listeria is commonly found in the environment and on the skins of fruit, and good food handling practice suggests washing the skin of all avocados before opening.
Trump has signed a proclamation formally recognizing the Golan Heights as part of the State of Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu was president in the Oval Office looking over Trump's shoulder during the signing of the proclamation. The Syrian foreign minister calls the proclamation a blatant attack on its sovereignty. Just before the meeting, the Israeli military started attacking Gaza once again, targeting offices of high-level Hamas leaders. The Israeli military action came after a rocket that allegedly came from Gaza struck a home in central Israel. Netanyahu cut his visit short and left right after the signing.
An Alabama lawmaker wants to eliminate all marriage licenses rather than issue them to same-sex couples. A bill approved by the Alabama State Senate would allow marriage licenses without a license or... A bill approved by the Alabama State Senate would allow marriages without a license or ceremony. The bill has been introduced by Republican Senator Greg Albertson every year since 2015, but it has never gotten this far before in the legislative process. Republicans had said they are interested in protecting judges who don't want to appear as if they are approving of ceremonies between same-sex couples. Similar legislation has been promoted in Oklahoma, where same-sex marriage is legal, but unlike Alabama, the bill did not pass.
The Oklahoma Supreme Court today denied a move by pharmaceutical corporations to postpone the start of the first state trials and lawsuits accusing the companies of fueling an opioid epidemic. Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter sued 13 opioid manufacturers in 2017, alleging they fraudulently engaged in marketing campaigns that led to thousands of overdose addictions and deaths. Last week, the corporations argued they needed more time to look through more than a million documents they received as evidence from the Attorney General last month. They requested a 100-day postponement of the trial scheduled to start May 28th in Cleveland County. A judge there had already denied the request. Hunter said Monday that the Supreme Court's ruling keeps the lawsuit on track for trial.
On today's episode of Climate Connections, we look at how climate change is going to impact tourism.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For Michelle Combs, energy policy is not a partisan issue. It's personal. Her interest began when she was pregnant with her son.
My doctor told me not to eat fish, and I said, why shouldn't I eat fish? And I found out it was because of the mercury that was in the fish.
Curious where that mercury comes from, Combs did some research, and she found that coal-fired power plants are the largest source of mercury pollution in the U.S.
And I was surprised. I said, I cannot believe that we as Republicans are not involved in this issue that is so important to the unborn.
In 2012, she started a group called Young Conservatives for Energy Reform. Members meet with conservative city, state, and county leaders to explain how policies that support solar and wind energy can help protect the air, water, and people's health.
I believe the issue of clean energy is not a Republican or a Democratic issue. I believe it is an American issue. And most importantly, I believe it is a family issue. And I am involved because I want us to be cleaner and I want us to make a better country for our future generations.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Extreme weather from blizzards to floods has marooned residents of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. The Washington Post reports today that some residents have been stranded in their homes for up to 2 weeks and are now isolated by rivers of mud. Rescuers are using horses, boats, and helicopters, but have still not reached all residents in trouble. Oglala Sioux tribe officials said they lack the training, manpower, and equipment needed to deal with such a large-scale crisis, but they also say federal officials have been slow to respond to their calls for help. A winter storm this month sent snow hurricanes into the Midwest. The extreme snow was followed by torrential rains, and officials say more than $1 billion in damages have been recorded.
Coal plants are changing the weather. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water.
A car powered by seawater? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Flooding last week in the Midwest took 3 lives and could cost billions of dollars in lost homes, crops, livestock, and even permanent loss of topsoil.
Heavy rains came during the recent bomb cyclone that dumped water on frozen ground, unable to absorb it. Earther reports that runoff in some areas of Iowa, Nebraska, and Missouri swept away productive topsoil needed to grow wheat, soybean, and corn, and replaced it with sand and silt.
The floods have also shut down nearly 15% of the country's ethanol production due to rail lines being washed out and corn storage being flooded.
Military bases have been affected. 80 buildings at the Offutt Air Force Base, home of the U.S. Strategic Air Command, were swamped. The Associated Press noted that flooding is an example of how weather extremes are not limited to the coasts and a dramatic example of how climate change poses a national security threat.
Flooding could persist for months due to snow melting in the northern states, according to NOAA, with 2/3 of the country at risk.
Last week, a judge temporarily blocked oil and gas drilling on thousands of acres in Wyoming because the federal government had failed to consider climate change.
The judge ruled that the government must focus not just on how drilling might affect plants, animals, and water near a site, but also on the consequences of burning the fuel once it's extracted. The case could have implications for drilling on all public lands.
Extracting and burning fossil fuels from federal lands generates emissions that equal almost 1.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide annually, which is about a quarter of all the emissions of CO2 in the U.S.
The New York Times reports that the suit in which the judge issued his order was filed against the Obama administration before the 2016 election, but the ruling could put a dent in the Trump administration's plans to expand drilling on public lands, including offshore.
There are 2 new studies about climate change. The first is from the USGS and shows that rising sea levels threaten California's economy 10 times more than extreme wildfires or earthquakes.
The report published in the journal Nature says that higher oceans mean storms could cause $150 billion in damage to coastline structures and put as many as 600,000 people at risk from flooding by the end of the century. But even in the next 20 years, much property will be vulnerable.
The second study is about CO2 emissions from high elevations of the Rocky Mountains. We've already known that permafrost melting in the Arctic can release greenhouse gases that have been trapped for centuries. But the new research suggests that snowy mountain ecosystems around the world also contain permafrost that may be in jeopardy as the climate warms.
The study from the University of Colorado and published in the journal Nature Communications finds that landscapes above 11,000 feet in the Colorado Rockies are leaking CO2 into the atmosphere more than they are capturing, and the leaked carbon was relatively old.
In summer, carbon is being absorbed by plants, but the study shows that greenhouse gases are being released during the colder months.
John Knowles, the lead author, told E&E News that something is happening to release carbon that had been stored for decades or even centuries, and research may suggest that the area had intact permafrost, but recent warming and environment change has caused the soil to degrade.
Electric vehicles are viewed as a good choice to reduce CO2 emissions, but there's another potential option for clean transportation, fuel cell vehicles, which use hydrogen mixed with oxygen to power an electric motor. The only byproduct is water.
However, there are several obstacles for fuel cell vehicles, including their high cost and a lack of infrastructure for filling stations. And although hydrogen is abundant on the planet, most of it is captured from fossil fuels, diminishing its potential as a green technology.
Harnessing hydrogen from fresh water is not desirable because it requires tapping into limited resources, and the process requires huge amounts of electricity.
But that may be changing. Researchers from Stanford announced last week that they have devised a way to generate hydrogen from seawater, using solar power to separate the hydrogen from oxygen.
They also solved the problem of salt causing corrosion, which has impeded efforts in the past. So the authors say if the so-called hydrogen economy takes off, their new method could increase the availability of fuel cell cars.
The wait may not be long. Bloomberg reports that a Canadian utility has agreed to test a system to extract hydrogen from seawater, and China is massively investing in technology and infrastructure for fuel cell transportation.
And finally, could a bathroom throne have a new noble goal to detect heart failure? It could, because of an innovative toilet seat invented by a team at Rochester Institute of Technology that monitors vital signs for those who have been recently hospitalized for the condition.
Heart failure occurs when not enough blood is pumped to meet the body's needs, but it doesn't mean that the heart has stopped or is about to stop. Rather, it needs support to function properly.
Symptoms of heart failure include shortness of breath, fatigue, and swelling in the ankles, feet, and legs. Therefore, the thighs are a good place to monitor because the body's largest artery runs through them.
The seats, which measure everything from blood pressure to blood oxygen, can detect deteriorating conditions before someone realizes they have a problem. And because the seats transmit data rapidly, interventions can be as simple as a drug change or a short office visit instead of readmission to the hospital, which happens with 25 to 45% of patients.
The inventors are working on FDA approval and hope to make their smart seat available for the nearly 1 million patients diagnosed with heart failure every year. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, March 25th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Jim Thompson, and Lisa Loving. And our engineers are Mike Fotoklis and Aiden Moyer. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving, and a podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe and Joe cover politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. At 9, Alternative Radio interviews author Shoshana Zuboff about her most recent book, Surveillance Capitalism. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11, it's Stage and Studio with D.May Roberts. Then at 11:30, Art Focus host Joseph Galavan interviews painter Char Breschgold about her show Hold On, Let Go at the Golden Gallery in Beaverton. And be sure to tune in to KBOO tonight at 11 for the Holy Crowley Hour with guests from the political satire podcast BS de Resistance. Good night, Ken. Good night, Aiden.
Good night, Ray. Good night, Aiden.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Ray.
Okay, Stefan, we're almost ready.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Resolutions Northwest offers its workshop on trauma, resiliency, and restorative justice coming up April 15th in Portland. This workshop's unique, and here to talk about it is Stefan Fowler of Resolutions Northwest. Stefan, thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Stefan, can you first tell us a little bit about Resolutions Northwest, maybe a little bit about the history and the mission of the organization?
Yeah, for sure. Resolutions Northwest is a nonprofit organization here in Portland, Oregon. I guess to say the mission is we facilitate honest dialogue to resolve conflict and advance racial and social justice. We provide trainings and consultation. We build skills and capacity, and we try to strengthen relationships. We envision inclusion and just communities in which people connect across differences and equitable shared opportunities to thrive. We encourage people, policies, and practices to shift systems and improve outcomes. We have three different departments. We have a restorative justice department, we have a mediation department, and we also have a community programs department. And each program does different things all in that capacity.
Well, since it's in the workshop name, why don't we start first with restorative justice? Can you explain the term and maybe a little how it differs from our current system?
Ooh, yeah, we can get right to it. for sure, restorative justice is, let's say, in our definition, RJ is a restorative justice, shortened to RJ. It's about changing systems to address harm more meaningfully and undo systems and patterns of institutional racism and oppression. It is a shift. And there's a passage that I'm actually going to read to talk about this shift.
Oh, sure.
And it gives, like, it's from Cheryl Graves of Community Justice for Youth Institute. It says, what's fundamental about restorative justice practices is a shift away from thinking about laws being broken, who broke the law, and how we punish the people who broke the laws. There's a shift to there was harm caused, or there's a disagreement or dispute. There's conflict, and how do we repair the harm, address the conflict, meet the needs so that the relationships and community can be repaired and restored? It's a different orientation. It is a shift.
I can see the difference between repairing, as in restorative justice, and revenge, which seems to be a lot of the justice system right now.
Right.
Punishment.
Yes, our system is very punitive. And in this state, we fall away from, like, really looking at the harm that's being done to how can we transform and really help and benefit the folks that are all involved. And with the current system in place, like, there's only certain things that get to happen via punishment, via there's outcomes are not, there's no restorative, there's no process where the folks that are involved can actually really get healing from it. And I think that is the shift that needs to change, is like looking at healing in a different way that is benefiting everyone that's involved, and personally and in the systems that has been harming folks historically.
Now, let's talk the personal part. Stefan, you actually have firsthand experience with our criminal justice system. When you were a teenager, you were sentenced to 7.5 years in the Oregon Youth Authority. Can you tell us a bit about that experience and maybe how it influenced your current work with Resolutions Northwest?
Yes, I can. And that's going to take up the rest of the interview.
We'll just go along.
Okay, for sure. My incarceration was actually where I learned about restorative justice. And I would say that time period of my life kind of shaped my identity to who I was going to become.
How old were you then?
when I first got introduced to restorative justice, I was probably 19.
When you were sentenced.
When I was sentenced, I was 17. Wow. Yeah, 17. And I didn't necessarily know what I wanted to do and who I wanted to be. All I did know was the past that brought me to where I was not going to be my future. And I had to do a whole lot of soul searching and finding. And when I found there was a volunteer group that came in and started to do restorative justice work, and really told me and showed me like there's a different way of thinking, based off of not the world owes me everything, but everything that I do has a ripple effect and has impacts on people. And once I was starting to realize that, I was able to see the world differently and just show up to spaces differently. And that was like a huge shift in myself.
And was that something that kind of created a spark right away that, kind of hit you right away? Or was that something that took a while to absorb?
I mean, it took a little while. And being a young African-American male in this system, there was definitely external forces and internalized things that was happening that was preventing me to see myself in the best light. And once I was able to really look at the world and see it from a view, and maturing, like a lot of folks think that young folks that get incarcerated, even if they get incarcerated with adult charges, that's just who they are. And I think we sometimes forget that young folks are still developing, still learning who they are. And that is the journey that I was still on. So once maturity started to catch on in my 19, early 20s, I was like, okay, I can really do some things that's different than what I've learned.
Now let's talk about the workshop itself. So this is a workshop on trauma, resiliency, and restorative justice. It doesn't seem like the usual workshop. What's different about it, and how many people are impacted by this?
That's a great question. So this restorative justice, trauma and resiliency, we know that children and adults who experience trauma often end up getting in trouble with authorities because their behaviors in response to triggers is misinterpreted as malicious or even violent. We would like to help people recognize that traumas like that are not labels. It is just an individual problem, but one that is rooted in historical and systematic oppression, such as racism. And we try to not pathologize people, but rather inspire folks to take action to change the context of what is traumatizing. We often refer to the essay, The Future of Healing, Shifting from Trauma-Informed Care to Healing-Centered Engagement by Dr. Sean Jenright, who views these exposed to trauma as agents of their own well-being rather than victims, and who considers activism and involvement in culture-based activities as components of healing. Restorative justice is a trauma-informed practice because it gives people a voice and examines unmet needs.
And this workshop is targeted more towards young people, to youth, probably to the age you were when you were incarcerated, right? To teenagers, 17, 18, 19 years old?
Actually, no. So it is more targeted and geared towards adults who work with youth. Ah. That is what we do. And a lot of, I guess, we need to be more clear about who this is targeting for. And anybody is available. You can come and just learn about trauma. And in no shape or form am I saying that we are trauma experts. We believe in the form of popular education, the folks that come to the room, and we facilitate the conversation, but it is based in research and knowledge.
So talk a little about who the intended audience will be for here, and listeners out there who might benefit from attending.
The intended audience is, like I said, folks is, that works with young people, and folks that work in systems, folks that work in organizations that claim to be trauma-informed or doing some type of work around trauma and trying to understand how it affects our day-to-day lives, and in the historical context, like why the systems of oppression continue to thrive and work how they do, and what trauma has that caused, like internally, and yeah.
Now, there were a few terms here. One, in the title of the workshop, resiliency. What do you mean by resiliency here? What will you be talking about?
Well, this is a debatable topic. resiliency, as stated, I guess, in the dictionary, is the ability to bounce back after adversity.
Right.
And we talk a lot about how, especially in school, since we're talking about young folks, are geared to people that's working with young folks, resiliency is almost being looked at as something to be celebrated. Like, we're going to teach kids how to be resilient. And that is not doing just to how resiliency is really created. And so we have this model of, like, we're not trying to celebrate resiliency, we're trying to honor resiliency, because to be resilient means that you had to go through some type of struggle. It's almost a survival tactic. And if you're looking at a historical context and who are the individuals, the black and brown kids that are really suffering and hurting in our school systems and in our systems, period, that resiliency was created from a historical platform and has consistently have been damaging folks. And so the resiliency piece is like, it's a necessity to survive. And to say that we need to celebrate this is almost saying we need to teach y'all how to navigate our racist systems instead of, let's change this racist system so that we don't have to have these kids going through these issues. Yeah.
And who will be leading the workshop when somebody attends? What can they expect? Some of the topics, it goes from 9 a.m. we mentioned to 4 p.m., so it's a full-day workshop. What are some of the topics you'll be covering?
Yeah, it is a long workshop. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that. What was the first question, part of that question?
Who will be leading the workshop?
Who will be leading it?
Will you be there as one of the instructors? Or
Yes. Me, myself, and my co-facilitator, Gabrielle Ross, an amazing facilitator. We've created this this training out of a lot of the things that she was already doing, and I think that it is for the folks that want to know kind of how resiliency, trauma, and restorative justice can intertwine and be talked about and be worked. So everything that we discuss in this training is around, like, what are trauma triggers? What are the things that can cause folks to be in a traumatic state? And we're more talking about chronicle and complex traumas, opposed to acute trauma, that just something that happens, but it's more of, what are the things that get us to these states and how can we notice them? And how can we look at the bigger picture on these are the systemic things that have caused some of these traumas, and how we can work through it, which is the restorative justice piece, because it's about breaking down the systems that hold these things
right
in place.
Now, Stefan, is the workshop full, or can listeners still sign up? If they can, how would they do that?
That's a great question. To be honest, I do not know if the current one that is on,
on the April 15th
is full or not.
There will be
upcoming ones, yes.
Okay, and we'll give the information on that. But again, thanks very much for coming into KBOO this afternoon.
Definitely. Like I said, thanks for having me. And yeah, appreciate the time.
We've been talking with Stefan Fowler of Resolutions Northwest about their upcoming workshop, Trauma, Resiliency, and Restorative Justice. It takes place Monday, April 15th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Northwest Health Foundation. That's at 221 Northwest 2nd Avenue, Suite 300. And you can get more information on the Resolutions Northwest website. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO Community Radio starts our spring membership drive starting April 8th. And before that, we'd love to hear from you directly about why you support KBOO.
My name is Mo, a KBOO volunteer, and I support KBOO because I grew up with KBOO. It's part of my life, and I feel having a community outlet like KBOO is so important because it creates a more vibrant community and a place where different ideas are not only heard, but honored. Why do you support KBOO? Call us and let us know at 503-231-8032, extension 302, to leave a voicemail or tag us with your support on your social media posts. And thank you for supporting KBOO.
You're listening here to KBOO Portland.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Amanda Hill, here with my co-host Jamie Partridge.
Hey, Amanda.
Hey, Jamie. And we're in the room with a bunch of troublemakers. Marge Hogan and Robert Cozy are teachers who went out on strike in Vancouver, Washington last fall. Hello, Marge and Robert.
Hi.
Hello.
And also with us is Johanna Brenner, coordinator of the Northwest Labor Notes Organizing Committee, which is sponsoring the April 6th Troublemakers School. Hello, Johanna.
Hi.
Johanna, why don't you kick off with a brief overview of the Troublemakers School to give our listeners a sense of the Troublemakers wing of the labor movement and the importance of this event, which happens only once every 2 years in the Portland area.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So Labor Notes was founded in 1973 by radicals who believe, I think correctly, that in the end, the bosses depend on our ability and willingness to work. And if we organize ourselves, we have power. We have power at our workplace. We have power with the people who employ us. And we ultimately will have power, people power, for the changes that we need in society. So this vision was that labor unions are an important organization of working people's struggle. And if they're bureaucratic, if they're top-down, if they're more interested in making deals than they are in actually defending workers' working conditions, then they're not doing their job. So